This is GeoTalks, a podcast by Blue Marble Geographics. This month on the GeoTalks podcast, we spoke to Dr. Arturo Sanchez Esofefa about his team's research in the Guanacaste Conservation Area at Santa Rosa National Park in Costa Rica. LiDAR technology, in addition to other methods of remote sensing, can be integral to performing accessible research in a given area. Dr. Sanchez Esofefa's team is in the process of creating accurate methods for studying secondary tropical dry forests with LiDAR technology. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the GeoTalks podcast. I'm Meg Scribner.
And I'm Mariah Hyduke.
Thanks for joining us on the podcast today, Mariah. I'm excited for you to be co-hosting with me.
I'm really happy to be here today, Meg. So thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm excited to introduce our guest for today's episode, Dr. Arturo Sanchez Esofefa. Welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, and thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here.
We're excited to discuss your work comparing LiDAR methods for studying deforestation in Costa Rica. Would you tell our listeners about your work in this field?
I have been working quantifying tropical deforestation since I was a young graduate student at the University of New Hampshire. We are close to you guys. I was quite surprised about the lack of information about a country that holds about 5% of the tropical biodiversity. At the beginning of my work, there was a very limited understanding of what was the deforestation in Costa Rica. Some people said that was 50%, though some people mentioned deforestation rates of 5% per year, and other people assumed that 80% of the country was cut. So I was actually centered on the question, what is the deforestation in Costa Rica and what is the rates? You can actually link deforestation patterns to socioeconomic forces driving the changes in Costa Rica. And also, it can be linked to biodiversity loss. So that, to me, was what started all this process about, I would say, it's going to be 30 years ago when I started looking at deforestation. So we have been very systematic over the years, using the same methodologies, the same approaches, to have a very long time series.
I think it's interesting that you contextualized your work with the questions you were hoping to answer. And I can see why you pursued studying forests. On that topic, would you tell us about your role in this research?
I am the principal investigator. I started in my master's, then I continued with my PhD. And then when I came to the University of Alberta, I was very lucky that I was allowed to continue working on what I'm doing. So I am the principal investigator of this project that is called TropiDry. And TropiDry is a project that aims to understand land cover changes and biodiversity losses in one specific ecosystem in Costa Rica, which is the tropical dry forest. This is the forest that is in the Pacific side of the country. Why Guanacaste and not other parts of the country? There have been a plethora of studies in the Atlantic region of the country, and we have very little understanding of the Pacific side, specifically the Northwest. That region has two very important characteristics. One, not only the dry forest, but it's a forest that loses its leaves during the dry season. It's a forest that, like the same thing that we see here in the fall, when trees go to sleep because there is a change in light and temperature. In Costa Rica, what we see is that those trees lose all their leaves and go to sleep because there is a change in soil moisture. So they are genetically designed, sort of speaking, to actually sense the dryness and then to protect themselves by losing all their leaves and going to sleep. That makes a humongous challenge for mapping those forests because traditional techniques, including new maps that we see, fail to identify the presence of those forests. So when they look at these forests and there is no leaves, they just turn and say, no, there is no forest here. They just forget about it. So we were challenged initially by designing protocols or workflows that allow us to identify those forests in the dry season. Because, of course, during the rainy season in the tropics, there's a high density of clouds. It's almost impossible to get a good satellite image.
That makes sense. While we're on the subject of factors that impacted your research, are there any other challenges that you encountered?
As you can imagine, there are a lot of challenges. The first challenge was economic, like always. Where is the money to support this? So I was very lucky to get funding from NSERC here in Canada, and also from the Canada Foundation for Innovation that allowed me to jumpstart many of the ideas that we had. The second challenge that we face is what is forest and what is not forest? You can have 10 trees and some people call it forest. You can have 1 hectare and some people call it forest. Other people may not call it forest and say, okay, the area is not good enough. The number of trees doesn't fit this specific definition by FAO or whatever. So we were confronted with the question of what is what we are mapping. We are actually mapping a degraded forest or just a forest. And our third challenge, I think, that came out after all of these things, we got very good at mapping the extent of tropical forest. The question is just not mapping the extent of the tropical dry forest, but what kind of forests? Are we looking at primary forests, at secondary forests? If you're looking at the secondary forests, one maybe think about it. Is this a forest that is 10 years old or 500 years old or 5 years old?
That's so interesting.
So we started working at the Guanacaste Conservation Area to answer that question. Many of my students that work on this is, okay, we know the forest, but how old it is? Why is it important? You say, why this is important? The most obvious thing is carbon sequestration. The young forests tend to absorb more carbon. Sometimes the old forests get into a climax part, but therefore the money is on the secondary forest. And the second one is the effect that those forests have on biodiversity. Those forests may create bridges between forest patches that allow biodiversity to move. Also, it has been documented that all of these forests tend to improve the quality of biodiversity that is in one specific region. So it's not only to understand where the forest is, but also extremely important to understand how old it is.
Thank you for telling us about that.
Yeah, I can understand why considering the age of the forest is important. Would you tell us more about the bridges you mentioned that connect the parts of the forest?
Okay, I think that the easiest way to understand this process is imagine a sponge. And the sponge has a bunch of little holes. And if you take the sponge and then you pour water at the top and you look at what percolates and what comes out at the bottom, this is exactly the same thing that looks at biodiversity. You put a bunch of elements in the top and this percolate through the forest and they look at this the connection between those empty holes to start moving all the way down to the bottom. So what happened with this? Imagine that you have a jaguar and the jaguar has to walk all the way from Guatemala to Colombia. Well, the jaguar will not take a plane. It will not travel by bus or neither by car. So the jaguar needs to walk all the way and the jaguar needs this connectivity between islands. So what we call biological corridors. So we are focusing on identifying where those biological corridors are and if they are actually feasible for biodiversity to move from one patch to the other. It's exactly the same thing. The only way that the jaguar can move all the way from the north to the south is by having all of these bridges. But that applies also to monkeys, to coatis, to butterflies, to birds, anything that you want. I remember Gretchen Daly and Paul Ehrlich did a fantastic job about the birds moving across corridors many years ago in Costa Rica. And I had the honor to work with them on that. So that is another layer of complexity, which refers to not only the extent of what is there, but also where is it? And if there is a connectivity within patches. Sometimes patches may grow, you have two next to each other and they start growing and they touch themselves. Sometimes they may use a river to connect themselves. But I think that the analogy of the sponge and the water moving through is probably the most cool way to understand how these things work.
Absolutely. I love the idea of these like corridors connecting these different environmental zones. That's so amazing to hear about. I think Mariah actually had a question.
Yeah, thanks, Meg. Arturo, I'm curious how you use GIS technology for this work.
This process is quite an important tool that we see it used every day by Conservation International, FAO, but also when I look at the evolution of GIS over the years in Costa Rica from literally very little infrastructure to what we have today, you can see that GIS plays an important role. I will not say that it's only GIS. I think that there is a combination of GIS and remote sensing. GIS helps us to visualize the final products that come out of the mapping. I believe that the best version of the GIS is the raster, because even though we have very powerful computers today, the level of fragmentation of some of these works is so high that there are millions of small polygons that even though you filter them, you still have problems. Nowadays, you have a Landsat 9, Sentinel 2 with resolutions of 20 meters, 10 meters. We have the Planet Lab, 5 meters, and whatever resolutions they have commercially. So that helps us to use GIS in a more efficient way. At least from my point of view, I think that if we have GIS from the raster point of view, we can do more. And that's why Global Mapper plays a very important role for us. It's designed for raster analysis using this kind of database. I mean, in fact, the processing is faster when you have raster vector and you are exposed to less problems like sliver polygons and little fractions that come there, comes out of the classification and so forth. When I was doing my PhD, they were doing the whole Amazon. I remember at the time David Skoll, Michigan State University, we did perhaps the first wall-to-wall inventory of a forest extent in the Amazons, and they did it with vector, and just was absolutely nightmare. I remember doing my PhD thesis, going into vector. I mean, the computers at the time were not actually able to run the GIS at the vector level, so you have to go back to the raster and trying to resolve that. So there are scientific evolutions in the world of GIS that are absolutely fantastic. I just wondering what will happen 5 years from today or 10 years from today.
It's moving along. It's crazy.
Not only that, but how Global Mapper is going to look. Who knows what it's going to be? It's so exciting. It's just so fantastic to think how the GIS is evolving.
Yeah, it's really crazy. I think that a lot of like automations and scripting are definitely helping people like get stuff done and like really engage with the research that they're doing. So that's amazing. I was actually interested in what you were saying about the resolution of the data, the 20 meter, 10 meter, 3 meter. What kinds of information are you looking for in that data and how is it impacting your research? I'm just curious about that.
To me, we have gone all the way to 1 meter resolution. We work in Costa Rica with a company called Stereocarto. And they have potent sensors and cameras that allow us to get things about 5 centimeter resolution. And if you go with a drone, you get 2 centimeter resolution. So it's not just having 3 meters or 3 meters or 20 meters. It depends on what you want. If we are trying to work at the regional level, let's say the whole conservation area of Guanacaste, we'll probably go with Landsat 9 because it allows us to do regional mapping very easily. If you have a partner that has found some fund and they decide to buy a piece of land to annex it to the Guanacaste conservation area, they may be very interesting to understand how this specific patch of forest fits into the local landscape. So you would like to not only look in more detail, because perhaps Landsat 9 will not give you that data, but you may like to go probably with 3 meters or 5 meter resolution to actually understand how these patterns of distributions of forests will actually link to a major national park. Now, the question is, what do we do with this ultra resolution that we have? And there are many applications. To my mind comes two of them, besides mapping the extent of tropical secondary forests at the local level. One of them is looking at tree mortality. Tree mortality is highly related to climate change. droughts in the dry forests are becoming longer, higher temperatures. The dry season is quite hot. They take longer. Instead of lasting 3.5 months, maybe last 4 months or 4.5 months. So the tree is not genetically designed to sustain 1.5 extra months of drought and they die. So high resolution data help us to map every year new mortality and give us a sense of how fast is the turnover of these trees and if there is a relationship between mortality and changes in temperature. And the second one is to study the proliferation of lianas. Lianas are, in North America, people tend to call it vines. If you go to some parts of North Carolina and Florida, you can see all these things hanging from trees, very, very thick branches going on all along the tree, all the way up. And then they put their leaves and eventually they end up killing the tree or reducing the potential of carbon accumulation in the tree.
That sounds intense. Could you tell us more about that?
There is a paper in 2002 that ranked or put out the idea of the 10 fingerprints of global change, global environmental change in the tropics. And they were, you know, hunting, deforestation, CO2 accumulation. And I was quite surprised to see that lianas are considered one of those 10 fingerprints. And you think about it, why? They're like parasites that attach themselves to trees and go up, and they tend to put a lot of leaves. And in fact, they may put up to 5 to 7% of the total leaf count on a tree. So people start thinking, oh, no, lianas are really bad. We have to cut them because we want the forest to grow, and they're getting too fast. And, you know, lianas love CO2. Once we had an experiment. Imagine that you have two chambers, and in one chamber you have a bunch of lianas growing at the same temperature that we have today. So we control only for CO2, and we control for humidity, for light, for whatever you want to imagine. But the only thing that we changed was the CO2 concentration. So we have one chamber with 340 parts per million, and I think that I remember well, the other one was 800 parts per million. Oh boy. When you got into the one with CO2, that stuff was like a jungle inside a chamber. I mean, they really love CO2. I mean, the jury is still out. Some people say, no, there is no effect. Other people say there is effect. No, the effect of lianas is more because they love disturbed environments. And when that tree falls in the forest or where someone going to cut a tree, there is more light and they grow faster. But man, I tell you, that changes in CO2, those plants, that's literally like some, one of my graduate students says, oh, we need a machete to get into this chamber because there's so much, wow, it really grow a lot. When we come back to the second part of why we use high resolution is because we had discovered about in 2008, 2009, we discovered that lianas tend to reflect more light in the green spectrum of light. So when you look at the spectra of the liana, there's a peak of 550 nanometers. So if you have a tree that absorbs a lot of light, this peak goes down. And if the tree is reflecting a lot of light, then we have more light being reflected in the canopy. So it's like having two different types of mirrors. One you call it the tree mirror, and the other one the liana mirror, and the liana mirror reflects more light than the tree mirror. So the high spatial resolution helps us with two things. The first one is to identify where they are, because we can literally see with our eyes where they are. And if this high spatial resolution has multispectral information, then we can look at the grid comport, because there is not much difference between the blue and the red or the near infrared, but the green part of the spectra is there that can help us to identify this. And it's quite interesting. I mean, we proved that in 2009, almost 15 years ago. And since then, other people have been observing the same thing. So I think that was a very critical discovery.
That's great news.
There is another way with spatial resolution that we can actually help us to detect the lianas, and it's high resolution LIDAR. The Stereocarta flights are also very high resolution LIDAR system that are also waveforms. I'm not going to go over this, but basically what we see is that lianas make the top of the canopy very smooth. It's like you take a blanket and you throw it over the tree Okay, so you see these smooth waves, and that if you don't have the blanket, then there is all this, you know, variability. So imagine that you take a blanket and you throw it over the tree, and that the lianas is going to look like that. They're going to be smooth. These high-resolution LiDAR help us to observe changes in microtopography in the trees. So when we actually detect that there is a change in a specific geomorphological parameters, I mean, you can imagine the way that we do it is we imagine the crown, like if it was a landscape, a micro landscape, and we see changes in the geomorphology of the landscape, sort of speaking. So the high resolution LiDAR combined with the high resolution photography can help us identify where are they, how they expand over time.
Thank you so much for sharing all of the work that you've accomplished. It's really inspiring seeing how much things have changed in just a short amount of time. I'm curious, looking towards the future, how can having an accurate understanding of deforestation enable change in Costa Rica?
But what we need to do is promote more conservation, because this is what's giving the little guys the tool to develop new business in the proximity of parks, ecotourism tours, places to eat, small hotels, and then more. It has been proven that deforestation happened inside of a protected, delicate ecosystem. You know, all the permits were given, everything is okay, but hello, the Constitutional Court said that that stuff is protected. So why you are allowing deforestation in a protected area? Think about it. Forests have different types of ecosystem services. Ones that we can see and ones that we cannot see. What is something that we don't see? Climate regulation, carbon sequestration, mycorrhizing the soils. There are things that are happening there, and they're helping the environment. They help us to produce water. We know that they're there, but we cannot see them. Intangible would be the word. If you go into a national park and you pay $40 to get in, you go there to see the birds, see the landscape, say, wow, look at all these trees and stuff like that. So this is a tangible ecosystem service that is being embedded into the price that you pay at the entrance of the park. And if you start promoting deforestation, like we're doing right now, then the international image of the country is going to be affected, because we see ourselves as leaders in conservation and sustainable tourism, but also it's going to be impacts in biodiversity, and then it's going to be impacts in the socioeconomic components, because there is people that live out of this. A large part of the little guys down there live out of this. And that we went from 4.5% in the 1980s to 0.1-0.2%. And then we are starting to see a peak in the deforestation rates. And that you can see that with this new government, we can see a spike on those deforestation. So your question is quite important. We are trying to bring awareness about this problem.
Thank you for sharing your work with us. For our listeners, where can they learn more about you and your work or connect with you?
Well, you guys can look at our website. It's called tropi-dry.org. And you guys can find everything that we do there. Or you can go to Google Scholar and check my name and find the different papers. About 70% of all the papers that we have published are shareable right now. They're open access. The ones that they are not shared is because they were a time in which this open access did not exist. So people can always contact me, and we're happy to provide a copy of this, especially the papers related to the early observations in biodiversity and changes in life zones and impacts on biodiversity. That's where people can find about this.
That is awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that. And we love when people's research is open access. So thank you for providing that. And I will absolutely link those resources in the description. So if any of our listeners are interested, they can check them out there. But other than that, thank you so much for joining us. It was great to chat with you about your work. That was amazing.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoy it.
Thank you for joining us. To learn more about this story, head to our website to read the blog, which includes some images from this work, or check out the description to see the resources we discussed. Thanks for joining us on the GeoTalks Pod. If you enjoyed listening, subscribe to our podcast and turn on notifications so you don't miss any episodes.